First, I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me to this nice conference. Today, I'll be talking about the work done with Simon on the scattering amplitudes of planar n equals 4 superion mu. In the first paper we did, we have some proposal for some new differential equations which are based on the symmetry of the theory. This equations is essentially means that we can deform the symmetry algebra to make all loop scattering amplitudes, or equivalently the super Wilson loop Youngian invariant. And we've also tested this differential equations to use them to compute amplitudes up to 3 loops. And then there'll be also some second part about some work in progress, which we further apply this equations to compute more amplitude. I'll present some new result. Okay, so the talk will be mostly from the amplitude point of view, so it's not very integrability, but I'll try to convey the message that the Youngian symmetry for scattering amplitude in n equals 4 seems to be very powerful, that it can be used to determine the amplitudes to all loops. And I hope that after I give you the all these examples, you will see that there are a lot of hidden structures in the scattering amplitude that wait us to explain or to use integrability. So first I'll give a review of the symmetry of the S matrix, and then I'll talk about our proposal. We can derive it essentially from the operator product expansion of the Wilson loop, and then I'll talk about first tests of this equation up to 3 loops. In the second part, I'll mostly focusing on a restricted kinematics, which makes the scattering amplitude much simpler than the full kinematics. And in this sector, we can the differential equation can be used to compute a lot of scattering amplitudes that are not computed before. Okay. So what do we know about the planar S matrix? As a bookkeeping tool, we can package all our external states in the theory into a super field. You see, including the positive and negative helicity gluon and the fermions and the scalars. And all of them will depend on this Grassmann variable, where this A is the R symmetry index. And the scattering amplitudes will be a function of this external momenta where which is lifelike, and we can decompose it into a spinner and its conjugate, but also depend on this Grassmann variables. So we will call this a super amplitude, and when you want to compute any component amplitude, you just set this eta to some value or integrate it out, you can get a certain component amplitude. So this super amplitude, there's a nice classification of this according to its R charge. So, you know, the amplitude can start with this so-called maximal helicity violating sector, and then next to MHB, and up to this parity conjugate of the MHB amplitude. This each of them will have a Grassmann degree 4k plus 8 in terms of this eta, where we'll call this sector k, the n to the k is the MHB amplitude. And it'll be useful to strip off the MHB chi prefactor, which is a degree 8 Grassmann, which has degree 8 in Grassmann variables, and this is a momentum conservation and super momentum conservation. This is a famous Park-Taylor denominator. So after stripping off the MHV chi, this part become particularly nice under the symmetry. We know that the I'll tell you what the symmetry has been used to constrain and even determine this amplitude. We know that n equals 4 has a super conformal symmetry. So at least at tree level, this should be symmetry of the S matrix. And indeed, there's a subtlety that this actually essentially caused by this denominator called holomorphic anomaly, so which makes the tree, even the tree level S matrix a little, not exactly invariant under this superconformal symmetry. But fortunately, this is not really an anomaly, as shown by this author. Most of them are here, that you can introduce a deformation of the superconformal symmetry generators, namely these generators, and which will make the tree amplitude invariant under superconformal symmetry. More interestingly, if we go to the planar limit, we'll find a dual symmetry. And this is actually a duality that between this scattering amplitude and a light-like polygon related to it. And this is a relation that for each light-like momentum, you can map it to a light-like edge of this polygon, and it's closed because momentum is conserved. We call this dual space, and you can also consider the dual chiral superspace by introducing this fermionic coordinate which related to the super momentum. The thing is that we find that scattering amplitude is not only invariant under this conformal symmetry of the original space time, but it's also invariant under this dual, the conformal symmetry of this dual space. And there's a Wilson loop along this polygon that can be computed, and it has been shown in a lot of cases that there's a duality exists between these two objects, the scattering amplitude and the Wilson loop. So this dual conformal symmetry was first observed as weak and strong coupling, and then later generalized to this superconformal symmetry. And at least at tree level, we can see explicitly that after you strip off the MHV tree factor, the S matrix is invariant under this dual symmetry. And what about loop level? We know that there are infrared divergence at loop level which will break this the symmetry. But you will see that symmetry is still working at loop level to constrain the amplitude. For example, the first example we know to all loop is this famous ABDK proposal for the four point gluon scattering, which has an exponentiated form. And using that, Byrne, Dixon, and Smirnov, they have proposed all loop ansatz, which will capture all the infrared and collinear divergence of a general scattering amplitude. So this is also an all loop ansatz exponentiated form, which depend on the cusp anomalous dimension and some other quantity that is essentially an exponential of the one loop amplitude. So if you subtract this BDS part from the amplitude, the remaining part will be finite and don't have any infrared and collinear divergence. The nice thing is that this BDS ansatz turns out to be a solution to the world identity of this dual conformal symmetry. So as I said, loop amplitude is not really invariant under this dual conformal symmetry, but the anomaly, the breaking of the symmetry is under control. So Drummond and the company, they proposed this anomalous world identity which all loop amplitude should satisfy. And BDS is indeed a solution to that equation. So you will see if you subtract the BDS part from the amplitude, the remaining can only be a finite function and also dual conformal invariant. So it will depend on the so-called conformal cross ratio made out of this kinematic invariance. Yeah, I was writing it in terms of the dual coordinates. For n point, you have 3n minus 15 cross ratios. So because you're considering a light-like configuration. And you immediately see that for 4 and 5 point, the BDS ansatz is exact. So in some sense, the all loop amplitude will be the exponential of the one loop in this form. Because it's the only solution to the world identity. And starting at 6 point, you will be allowed to have a finite remainder function, which will be conformal invariant, as I said. Okay, so not only there's this dual superconformal symmetry, but there's also this duality that map first observed at strong coupling and later at weak coupling, that this MHV amplitude is equivalent to a non-polygon Wilson loop in the dual spacetime, as this picture showed. And the thing is that the superconformal symmetry of the original spacetime can be mapped to this dual superconformal symmetry under t-dualities from the string side. And in the following, when I talk about this Youngian symmetry of the amplitude, it's equivalent to saying that the amplitude is invariant under both the superconformal and this dual superconformal symmetry, because this dual superconformal symmetry can be viewed as the level one generator. Original one is the level zero. And as this author has shown, that there's indeed they generate this infinite dimensional Youngian. And our task would be continue this consideration that even though loop amplitudes break the symmetry, we can try to write down some kind of anomaly equation which will use all the generators, both level zero and level one, to constrain and even fully determine the scattering amplitude. And this duality I've been talking about was first proposed for the MHP amplitude and the bosonic Wilson loop, but later it has been generalized to this super amplitude and Wilson loop. So it depends on the Grassmann variables. And this will be the super connection. And this has been this duality has actually been proved at the integrand level, actually by Mason Skinner and also Simon, that they show both quantity at the integrand level satisfy the same recursion relation, which is a generalization of the tree-level BCFW recursion. So there's some regularization issue, but this won't be very important for us. And I also want to say that although you already see that the dual conformal anomaly is not really an anomaly, there's still some issue with this chiral super Wilson loop, and actually also the issue with the scattering amplitude, because it's in a chiral formalism. It at least obscures one half of the super conformal symmetry, because you are writing everything in terms of eta or theta, not in terms of eta bar or theta bar. So in this chiral formalism, you cannot see one half of the symmetry. So there's a, I won't elaborate on this, but there's a generalization that you also consider theta bar. It will be a super Wilson loop in this full n equals 4 superspace. That object is supposed to manifest the full symmetry, but that object is not dual to scattering amplitude, at least at the moment we understood that. It's something more general. It depends on both eta and eta bar. But this perspective will be useful for the following talk, because we will see that actually this one chiral half of the symmetry is also not broken. There's no anomaly at all, and they are actually related to higher order when you expand in this theta bar variables. Okay, so the object we consider will be this so-called BDS subtract S matrix. That's just for convenience. It doesn't mean anything. We just subtract the BDS part from the amplitude, and as I said, this remaining piece will be finite object depending on conformal cross ratio, and because you are considering super amplitude, NK MHP amplitude, so this object can also depend on some fermionic object, which is a dual super conformal invariant called R invariant. And it has nice collinear limits, and the reason we consider this is because this is already invariant under the dual conformal symmetry, because BDS captures all the breaking of the symmetry. But as I said, it's not entirely invariant under this dual superconformal symmetry, because we're using a chiral formalism. So our task would be find some anomaly equation for the broken generators. And it turns out that actually by doing that, the equation means that you can make the scattering amplitude invariant under some deformed algebra. And a convenient way to describe our equation is to use this twister of the dual superspace, because we'll be mostly focusing on the dual symmetry and not the original superconformal symmetry. It turns out the dual symmetry already been very powerful to determine the amplitude. So we'll use this twister of the dual space introduced by Hodges, which we call momentum twister. It's just the twister constructed in this dual space by this dual coordinate. And you can construct all this conformal cross ratio, also called R invariant, out of this twister. This won't be very relevant for the rest, but I just want to show you that this bosonic part of the twister can form some four bracket, which will give you the cross ratio, as I showed before. And also, you can use five super twister to construct an R invariant, which has degree four in the Grassmann variable. So when you construct next MHV amplitude, it will be order one in this R invariant, and higher n to the k symmetry will be order k. That is just the building block of this amplitude. And in terms of this momentum twister, all the generator of the dual conformal super conformal symmetry become first order differential operator. You can see that we package all this bosonic generators as this derivative as this derivative, and also the R symmetry. These are already preserved by the BDS subtracted amplitude, as I said. And also by construction, the amplitude is invariant under this one chiral half of the supersymmetry, and also the superconformal boost, because this is simply some fermionic derivative, and we construct all our amplitude in terms of this all invariant. It's by construction the invariant under Q, but this generator is quite non-trivial. It's a first order bosonic differential operator. It is the other chiral half of the supersymmetry and the superconformal boost. So in the remaining, I'll tell you what's the Q bar acting on this BDS subtracted amplitude. That is our proposal. So basically, we express this Q bar acting on all loop NK MHV amplitude, which is a first-order differential, first-order derivative of this object, as a one-dimensional integral. This is actually one-dimensional integral of some amplitude with one more particle. But then you take this additional particle to be collinear with its adjacent one, and then you do this integral over the parameter which parameterize the collinear, and it will be proportional to our loop expansion parameter, which turns out to be this cusp anomalous dimension. So the idea is that we make BDS subtract amplitude also invariant under Q bar. So we'll view the right hand side as some deformation of the Q bar, and it turns out it has the right form. It's this as I said, there will be also a second part, but this is not essential because this is the first part is the really the physical part. The second part is just because you subtract the BDS and it will give you some part proportional to a collinear limit of the chi amplitude. So our main proposal is that this differential equation that we believe it should hold for any value of the coupling. And it turns out that this together with its parity conjugate will be able to determine the all loop amplitude in principle. So the right hand side, I should explain this measure. You take this additional particle to be collinear with the adjacent one. So in terms of momentum twister, it's just this plus epsilon. And then you have a tau parameter, which is like a momentum fraction of this additional particle. And you need to integrate over this tau. So tau, in terms of Wilson loop, tau will parameterize this additional particle inserted along the position of the insertion along this edge n. And after you integrate over tau, first of all, you need to integrate fermionically. That's basically trivial. It gives you this R index of the generator. And you also, after you integrate over tau, you also do a contour integral, which will pick the residue at this collinear limit. And it's also proportional to this plane that has another index of this generator. So this is our equation. It's very simple. It's a differential, first order differential equation where the right hand side is essentially a one dimensional integral. And, there's another equation because this, as I said, already, take care of all the, generators in dual superconformal symmetry. You can see that the right hand side is nicely Q invariant. This right hand side of the Q bar equation. So if you apply Q again, you get zero. That will imply the dual conformal invariance of this BDS subtract amplitude as we expected. But there's also this level one generator, which is the original superconformal generator. The only one that is that BDS subtract amplitude is not invariant is so-called Q1, which is exactly the parity conjugate of this Q bar. The parity conjugate in the original space-time. So we don't need to derive an equation for that. We just take the parity conjugate of the right-hand side and we get this similar equation for Q1. But in terms of momentum twister, Q1 is a second-order I mean, differential operator. So it's, this equation will be slightly more complicated. But we have seen that by Q bar equation and its parity conjugate, we have listed all the anomaly of the amplitude under the full, Young-Gain symmetry or the level zero and level one generators. So I want to emphasize that this equation, doesn't really mean there's an anomaly. It should be viewed as a statement about the Young-Gain invariance of the S matrix. Because as this authors have explored that, the integrals like this can be viewed as a deformation of this generator because it's like a 1-2-2 split that you have one additional particle. So in this paper, they first studied a tree level and then also one loop and even higher loop, that they have, many terms. But our improvement is that we consider this BDS subtract amplitude, which makes the right-hand side especially simple. And also we are considering the amplitude as an integrated object, not an integrand. But, the key thing is that you should view the right-hand side as a deformation on these generators. So under this deformed, Young-Gain symmetry, the scattering amplitude is invariant under the symmetry. And this, since the right-hand side is proportional to gamma cusp, so this is actually the quantum corrections to these naive generators. And we won't explore this a lot, but we would really, for the convenience, we'll really take this as some differential equation where this is the right-hand side. And we claim that this is valid for any value of the coupling. Actually, the explicit dependence on the coupling is only through this gamma cusp. And when you expand amplitude, so this we believe is some all-loop statement, and when you expand amplitude at weak coupling in powers of this gamma cusp, you're actually relating some L-loop amplitude to the integral, derivative of L-loop amplitude to the one-dimensional integral of some L minus one-loop amplitude, but with one more particle, of course. So this equation will be very powerful as differential equation because first of all they are quite elegant equation. You can see that both sides are finite. So we already subtracted all the divergence by BDS ansatz, and they are regulator independent. I'll derive this equation later. You will see that if you only consider original amplitude, this equation might depend on the regularization scheme, but when you take this special combination called BDS subtract amplitude, this equation becomes very nice. And also it manifests the transcendentality of the scattering amplitude. Say here you have some L minus one loop amplitude which has transcendentality 2L minus 2. When you do the one dimensional integral, it becomes 2L minus 1. That is exactly what we expected as the first derivative of some L loop amplitude. And in a minute that this equation are very powerful that they actually determine the full S matrix. So these are equations about the S matrix, differential equations, and combined with collinear limit, we'll find that the solution to this equation will be uniquely the all loops S matrix. Okay, so I'll briefly discuss the derivation of this equation. The starting point is that you view the Q bar acting on a Wilson loop as a Fermi insertion. This is already explored by Simon in his earlier paper, that he can actually compute the Q bar of Wilson loop using this definition, so it's a Wilson loop with Fermi inserted, by Feynman diagrams. But here we have something more powerful. We see that the right-hand side is not really a new object. So it's this Fermi inserted Wilson loop can be related to a Wilson loop with one more edge by the OPE. So basically, you see that the Q bar acting on Wilson loop is given by the first, basically by the collinear integral of amplitude with one more particle, but there could be some renormalization, so there will be an overall factor depending on the coupling. Then you can also have the second term. This is exact. So this is based on our observation of this Fermian insertion, and this is exact. When you act Q bar on BDS, you just simply get the collinear integral of some tree level amplitude. But since you want to combine these two terms to study Q bar acting on a finite object, the right hand side better be finite. And indeed, when you do this tau integral, you will find endpoint divergences at both endpoints. But when you combine these two, the condition for the divergence to cancel is that this factor will be also gamma cusp. So they are relative coefficient is determined when you combine them to want to have a finite quantity. So a very important thing is that we want to check that our observation is indeed correct, that the right-hand side is a single Fermi insertion. So here is the idea, that Q bar is expressed as an insertion of fermion along some edge of the Wilson loop. And this can be related to Wilson with one more edge, but taken in the collinear limit. So these two edges in the limit will become one. And we'll see that this picture of single Fermi insertion is indeed correct. So for that purpose, what we really want to study is a slightly more general object where you take this Fourier transform with respect to the position of this Fermi insertion. So this P will be the momentum of this Fermi insertion. As studied by Benjamin, that this in general, if you have a single Fermi insertion, you will have this leading log divergence of this object. So this will be the dispersion relation of the fermion, and this will be form factor. And this is universal. So we want to study if our equation can give you the same dispersion relation as studied by using integrability by Benjamin. So we have this two loop result of hexagon next to MHB amplitude, and we can expand it to second order of this gamma cast by study this object. It's our original object is like the zero momentum part of zero momentum case of this integral, where you just get the total tau integral. But we can study more general, so we get this log epsilon divergence. Epsilon is the collinear parameter for collinear limit. To second order, it indeed agrees with what Benjamin Basso has obtained. So this tells us that the observation that our Q bar is a Fermi insertion and is related to this collinear limit of Wilson loop with one more edge is indeed correct. And the prefactor of our right-hand side should be gamma cusp. And this also gives us a byproduct. You see that if you consider the total tau integral would be the zero momentum of this fermion, and we don't really want, for the our amplitude case, we don't really want the right-hand side to pick up any log epsilon divergence. So the cancellation of this log epsilon divergence will be essential for us. And it is indeed true because as in this paper, Benjamin showed in this paper that this is actually the Goldstone fermion, for the supersymmetry breaking, induced by the Wilson loop. So when you take the zero momentum case, the dispersion relation is zero. The energy is zero. So you never have any log epsilon divergence on the right hand side. So this is also a consistency check of our equation. Okay, so much about the equation and its derivation. I'll tell you, why it is useful. So in principle, we get some derivatives of the amplitude using our equation if we can evaluate the right-hand side using lower loop amplitude. But how can we say that this will determine the amplitude? That's what I'm going to show you. So combining Q bar and Q1 equation, this can in principle determine all loop amplitude. But even just Q bar, we will see it's very useful. So Q bar is essentially the derivative. If you take this fermionic derivative, it just gives you all the bosonic derivative acting on the amplitude. So for the MHV case, where we don't have any dependence on the fermion, this is just some function of this bosonic coordinate, and Q bar equation gives you all the derivative. So it determines this MHV amplitude up to a constant. And this constant can be fixed by collinear limit. As I said, this remainder function has a very nice collinear limit. And by using the fact that the right-hand side is some integral of next to MHV, we can even determine what the total differential should look like. So it's always, the total differential is always the sum of this d log of this four bracket for some I and j. And this f will be some pure transcendental function. This is a form that will be correct to all loops from our equation. It's a natural consequence. And this proves the conjecture of Simon that the total derivative of MHV remainder function always take this form. More interestingly, that the Q bar equation can also give you all the derivative you need for the next to MHV amplitude. So I won't show it here, but the Q bar equation actually determine uniquely the natural symmetry amplitude up to a linear combination of all invariant. So natural symmetry amplitude will be expanded in terms of all invariant with coefficient being some transcendental function. So our equation, Q-bar equation alone, can be solved, and the solution will be the next to MHV amplitude to all loops up to some constant to this transcendental functions, to this coefficient. So in the following, I would just use the Q-bar equation to compute amplitude up to three loops, but for MHV and next to MHV. But if you go beyond, you will see some counterexample that some non-trivial piece will be invariant under this Q-bar. So that would be that means Q-bar equation won't be enough to determine amplitude beyond next to MHV. But luckily, we also have this Q1 equation, and there's a theorem proved by Chomsky and company, also by German and Farrow, that if you have an object that is invariant under all this naive generator Q, Q-bar, and Q1, it can be nothing but the so-called Young-Gain invariance given by this Grassmannian formula of Akani Hamid and company. So we know all the homogeneous solution to our differential equations to Q and both Q bar and Q1. By solving this equation, we determine the all loop NK MHV amplitude up to some combination of such rational invariants, which is given by the Grassmannian formula. So in that sense, the Q bar and Q1 equation determine all loop amplitude. And if you use collinear limit, you have enough collinear limits, and you can also determine this remaining rational piece. Okay, this is just some previous checks of our equation. I'll just summarize them here. The first nice thing is that it's almost trivial to use the one loop next to MHV heptagon and compute its collinear integral to give us the total derivative of two loop MHV hexagon. So this is an object that has been studied by Cloud and company, and also later simplified using the tool of symbol by Christian and collaborators to get this very nice formula. This is the one line formula for this two loop MHV hexagon remainder function. It's a transcendental fourth function, and we can immediately confirm that our Q-bar equation gives the correct total differential of this object. And if you integrate it, you can get this form. And we can also work for higher point at two-loop MHV. But it's getting more and more complicated because you have more and more cross ratios when you go to higher point. So generally, we only compute its symbol. We haven't tried to compute the function. And also, as I said, you can also determine next to MHV. So two-loop next to MHV hexagon, we have computed it, and the function agrees with this works. And you can also compute higher points, but now it's even more complicated. You have many functions where each of them will depend on many cross ratios. So this is the in general we can do this, but it's not very convenient. And I'll show you that in a special sector, everything will become much simpler. So the last thing we have checked, and it's also kind of some new result, is that we use this collinear integral. So we use the Q-bar equation again. We use the collinear integral of this two-loop next to MHV heptagon to get three-loop hexagon remainder function. And this has been derived by Dixon and the collaborators using some ANSARs and assumptions. Especially they use OPE constraints to constrain the ANSARs they propose, and they can determine the symbol. So all the computation beyond this example and the two-loop next to MHV hexagon will be is currently only about the symbol. We haven't got the functions for all these objects. So they derive they have an ANSARs for the symbol of three-loop hexagon, but up to two parameters that they haven't fixed. And using our method is like it's not a bootstrap method. It's more like a derivation of this symbol, and we find an agreement with their ANSARs, and also we can fix these two coefficients. So this will be a complete symbol of this three-loop guy. But as I said, all these examples are not very, mostly limited to this simple case. Beyond that, we only know the symbol. So I'll start to consider a restricted kinematics, which is still non-trivial enough and has very nice and interesting structures in amplitudes of this, with this restricted kinematics. But it will allow us to compute amplitude much more efficiently. And using Q-bar equation, we can get many explicit and new results that we want to use as data to find the underlying picture. So we know that studied as strong weak coupling that if you embedded the amplitude, external momentum or the edges of the Wilson loop in a two-dimensional subspace, the amplitude or the Wilson will simplify significantly. So for our purposes, it's even more natural to consider this reduction from 4D to 2D supersymmetrically. So the symmetry will factorize to some even sector and odd sector. So basically, the Wilson loop will look like a zigzag polygon that for even label of particle or label of particle, they are in different directions. And in terms of momentum twister, it just looks like this. You have for the odd momentum twisters, you have this. For the even ones, you have another non-zero component. So in this, this doesn't mean you lose much, because all the internal line will be still in the four-dimensional, just the external momentum. It's just a special kinematics that you can get much simpler result. So, for example, the four brackets I talked before will factorize into this more familiar two brackets. There will be the two brackets of this spinners of even or odd particles. And you can you find that cross ratios are essentially one-dimensional. There will be a ratio of these two brackets. And for our purpose, we also consider this superamplitude. So before, I didn't really go into the details of this R invariant. Here you'll see it simplifies a lot. The R invariant will become products of some even, you know, mini R invariants and some odd ones. These are just degree two fermionic functions with this two bracket. And you can construct all your amplitude in terms of even and odd R invariant. For example, chi amplitude will be just a trivial combination of this R invariant. And we also define, for example, degree two R invariant like this. It depends on four labels. But loop amplitudes will be much more interesting. It's the combination of this R invariant where the coefficient, as I said, are some transcendental function of cross ratios. So in this case, we'll have n minus five independent cross ratios. Our task will be using our equation to determine this coefficient, this transcendental function. So we expand our amplitude next to MHV or n squared MHV in terms of the basis of this R invariant, and the coefficient are these functions of a cross ratio which are very non-trivial at loop level, and we will use our equation to determine that. So our equation becomes simpler in this special kinematics, that is right hand side you take a polygon with two more particles and do this simple integral. This is the definition of the measure. It's still a one-dimensional collinear integral. So we can use it to determine the amplitude. The first nice example is that we can try to determine any number of points, the two-loop MHV. So before I showed you the 6 point in the full kinematics, it turns out, as already studied by these authors from amplitude and the OP perspective, that for any number of particles, this two-loop MHV amplitude can actually be written down quite explicitly. It's just a bunch of products of logs of the cross ratio. And from our from our computation, this is almost trivial. The most difficult part is to write the n squared MHV tree amplitude in this case. But we manage, if you manage to do that, then you can apply our equation twice to get the two-loop MHV amplitude, which agrees with their result. And the byproduct is the one-loop next MHV, which in principle we know, but I believe in 2D kinematics this is also some new result we write down. The one loop next to MHV amplitude is always expanded in a basis of such R invariant. And then the coefficients are some function of cross ratio. For example, the octagon, you can expand it in terms of 9 R invariant. One of them we choose to be the tree. And the other 8 is cyclically related of this cyclic image of this R invariant. And we have 2 independent functions to determine for octagon next to MHV. And it turns out they are very, very simple. They are just products of 2 logs of this cross ratio. And similarly, we have for any number of points, the one loop next to MHV. So you already see that for the restricted kinematics, the amplitude really simplifies a lot, that you can get some all number of point result. And, but this seems to be a little bit too trivial. So at one loop, you only have products of two logs, and at two loop, it seems that you only have product of four logs. And this has led to some expectation that the 2D kinematics is essentially trivial. In the sense, I mean, if you go to higher loops, you obviously you will have some like polylogarithm, not just product logs. But there have been some expectation that even if you go to three loop and or two loop next to MHV, things like that, you always have factorization of functions depending on one cross ratio and another. That seems to be mean that the restricted kinematics is a bit too trivial. But as we will show that we've computed some new result, two loop next to MHV and three loop MHV level, that this is not true. So you'll start to see some new structures, which will mix these cross ratios, which is nice because that means, you have a very rich structure at higher, this is just some, at higher loop because this is just some, simple case. But on the other hand, we find this result is still very compact. Actually, we find those mixing part, which is the most interesting part, is especially compact. The result is very nice. But the factorizable part is a bit lengthy, but that is not the part we're interested in. It's just some product of one function of one variable and a function of another. And another feature is that in the following, we study that another nice feature of the result is that once you have some eight point amplitude, higher point amplitude seems to be a sum of this 8 point result. For example, 8 point, you everything depends on two cross ratio. So as I said, you have a mixed part and some factorized part. But if you go to higher point, it seems that the mixing part of the higher point amplitude is some combination of octagons where every time you have two cross ratio out of the many cross ratios you have. Okay, I will show you the result for that's basically as far as we can do using Q-bar alone. Namely one loop in squared MHV and using Q-bar to get two loop next MHV and finally get three loop MHV. We see this new feature of some combination like difference of cross ratios. They will appear in the answer. So it's not the simple expectation we had before. The result is non-trivial and very interesting, but still it's very simple. So the one loop in squared MHV can be easily written down. So I want to say something is that this is not a trivial reduction of the 4D amplitude because we don't know how to do that actually. Taking the 2D limit of the 4D, for example, box expansion of n squared MHV is extremely complicated, but we can have some answers for the two loop for the 2D answer, and it turns out to be very very simple. It's just proportional to the tree, and you have this mixing of cross ratio as a rational prefactoring in front of this transcendental function. So this is essentially the two D analog of the box function you had, four mass box function you had in for the n squared MHV. And the result is very simple. You have a cyclic of this guy. You start to see dialogue, but more importantly, you start to see some mixing. Although here it's only as a prefactor. You will see through Q bar, it will goes to two loop and three loop answer as arguments of the transcendental function. You can, and as I explained, you can also go to higher point, and these two nice features will appear. First of all, you see at 10 point, this is the mixing part. So in this part, you have some function which also depend on the mixing letters that is similar to 8 point. This is very very compact. You just have function similar to 8 point, but then there will be some part which is just log terms, and also it doesn't have any non-trivial prefactor. It's a factorized part. That part is actually more lengthy, but we don't really care. This is the really interesting part we have here. And another feature is that this is a combination of 8 point amplitude. So one loop in square MHV, you already see this feature. Now we go to two loop next to MHV octagon. So using this 10 point result at one loop in square MHV, you can use Q bar to determine the two loop next to octagon. There's an ambiguity we haven't fixed, but it's very simple. It's just proportional to the one loop octagon. So basically, we know that it would be, for example, pi squared over 3 times that, but we haven't explicitly done that. But in principle, this two loop next symmetry octagon is expressed through these two functions up to maybe a pi square, which is as I've shown here. So any loop next symmetry octagon can be expanded like this, and we depend on two functions. At one loop is extremely simple. At two loop, it's slightly more complicated. You see that there is this mixing. So you already, this is not expressible through classical polylogarithm. So you have this the 2, 2 functions. And then there'll be a classical part, which is not bad. And the second function, which is coefficient of tree amplitude, is very, very simple. It's just a classical combination of this polylogarithm of degrees 3 and lower. So the most interesting part is here. You see the mixing. But we can even make it more compact. So what we really want to study is expansion of this, and then we can do some Fourier transform of the result. So this is the more compact result we obtain. We studied only the interesting function, the first one, and this first function is actually also an amplitude. It by itself is a component amplitude of the next symmetry octagon. And we can expand it in terms of as small x, so x is the first cross ratio, so there will be some polynomial of this v variable and with this coefficient. And there's a part which is the discontinuity at v equals 0. It's very simple. The coefficient is just like this. Then there's the remaining part. It looks a bit lengthy, but only this part is really interesting because this second two lines, also these two terms in the discontinuity, are just factorized terms. So they are a term which depends on n. You know, depends on n means depends on x, and the term which depends on w. And it's always, you know, the degrees of this product is 4. So this parts are just some function of x, some function of v times some function of w. We don't really care. What we really care is this. These terms, which has a mixing, you see, it depends on w to the n. This is the feature of the mixing, and this regularized just means you need to subtract the polynomial when you take w to infinity. It's also very simple. Actually, after you're taking this, the full result of this mixing part can be written really nicely in terms of after doing a Fourier or Mellin transform. So I also want to mention here that the discontinuity part agrees with the OPE leading order prediction, but there are also this part, which are interesting, and all of them combined together, if you do this Mellin transform with respect to V and W to go to this momentum space, it's just a simple one-term result. So this is our main result for the two-loop next MHP amplitude. There will also be some function, some products of function of P and products of function of Q, but we don't really care. So this is really the Fourier transform of our mixing part of our result. And we can also, so as I said, the feature is that the mixing part is really, really simple. And then we can also go to higher point. For example, we can go to 10 point for the next MHP. Where?
That's a two-loop result, right?
Yes, yes.
So shouldn't you have log V and log V square? Why do you have only log?
Okay, so if you take the limit that V is very small, this will proportional to log V squared. Because the coefficient of this log V also depend on N. And it's actually a dependence. If you take the limit, so this is just an expansion, but if you take the limit of V goes to zero, you have a leading contribution, which is log V squared, not just log V.
Okay.
Yeah. So we can also have 10-point next MHP, which is essentially a sum of 8-point result, as I said. And based on that, we can derive a three-loop octagon in this special kinematics. And the nice thing here is that we can actually integrate it, the symbol to get complete function up to two constants. These two constants will be some pi square multiplying the two-loop result and also the two-loop next MHP function, this function. And basically, we think it's just pi square over 3 or something. So all other beyond the symbol ambiguities are fixed. And these are fixed using the also using the OPE leading predictions. Like when you take the limit that v goes to 0, you have log v cube and log v square terms. And it turns out that the beyond the symbol ambiguities are fixed by the OPE predictions, the leading predictions. So if we write the result like this, it's very complicated, but as we have learned, it's better to expand it at small v. So this is the result we get. The coefficient of the v to the n's will be something like this. So here you also only see a log v, but the remaining piece depend on n. So it doesn't mean it only has a log v term. It has log v squared and beyond. So this is our final result. The remaining piece of this, the coefficient of v to the n's is like this. It's very similar to what you had here. It's essentially the same function of w, a transcendental function. But here w to the power, not only you have the highest w to the n's, but you also have lower orders. And this c are just some numbers, which here you have n squared and n to the cube. N to the cube, but here you have like 1 over n to the fourth and 1 over n to the fifth for this c numbers. And we expect that if you do a Mellin transform of this mixing part, you'll get a very nice result analog of this. Possibly you'll have psi of p plus q, not just psi p or psi q. And we have seen that this example is to provide a rich set of data, and it's non-trivial, but it's still very compact, suggesting that there are some underlying picture that we should understand. So the next task will really be try to understand all these nice structures from integrability. And let me summarize. Essentially, we just have a proposal for the Youngian inference of the all loop S matrix in planar n equals 4. It's a quantum corrected algebra, and using this equations, you can compute the amplitude. The equation is actually determine the amplitude, and we have tested up to 3 loop and also against the OPE integrability result. And we have also seen that the equations provided a lot of new data for the S matrix. So we hope this new data will give us insight into the integrability of the scattering amplitude. Thank you.
Any questions?
I just wanted to ask, does your construction or your more data points that you get, your more examples, give any particular hints about the type of transcendental numbers that appear at certain loop orders and helicities, like you know, you have polylogs and then you have harmonic polylogs appearing. Do you have any kind of intuition?
It's still far from that at the moment. Yeah. Because if we use both equations, we can expect to go to higher loops. But at the moment, we're only using Q-bar, so we're limited to 3 loops. And I expect more new structures like beyond this polylogarithm and multi-polylogarithm will appear at higher loops.
Yeah. Any other questions?
Does it come down with the CT2 parabolic? It's rather a comment. It's rather a comment which I want to make. I don't understand the basic philosophy of defining the remainder function is the subtraction of something divergent minus something completely arbitrary, which is BDS. An arbitrary subtraction of the divergent part. What we can prove, and we know why it works, is that it removes the conformal anomaly. But why Q bar? You subtract it from something arbitrary. And now you study the Q bar symmetry of this more or less arbitrarily defined remainder. Why do we expect that it should have any properties?
Well, I would say the physical content is that Q bar acting on the amplitude is given by the first term by a collinear limit of amplitude with one more particle.
You didn't really explain why this is so. It's just a conjecture, maybe.
We have a derivation in terms of the Fermi insertion.
I didn't get anything from that.
Yeah, this equation is the content. If you forget about this BDS, this equation is actually the physical content. But generally, both sides are divergent. I agree. You have to regularize the thing.
Yeah, but the subtraction procedure always introduces something arbitrary, which in this case is BDS. And then how do you control the rest, whether it has some symmetries or not? It requires a special study.
Okay. Because the subtraction happens on both sides. So we are relating the remainder to some remainder where we do the subtraction, the same subtraction. So in principle, yeah, we don't need to do that, but it's just for the convenience of the calculation that if you subtract BDS on both sides, this is the equation you expect. And it turns out this equation can determine the remainder. That's just the, yeah. Fine.
Okay. Oh.
So since you say that you deform the generator, you have a deformation of the generator and you still talk about Youngian symmetry, did you really check that the defining relation of the Youngian algebra are satisfied by your generators?
Yeah, I think so. So by this equation and this Q1 equation, you can check the algebra, the Serre relation that it holds. Yeah, it holds for the own shell.
For the corrected one, with all these right-hand side that depends on...
So, yeah, we didn't really put the right-hand side here to write it as a correction, but you can track that acting on the... So, the algebra holds when you're acting on this amplitude. That's what you can check.
But because zero is equal to zero. Okay, but... it's not...
I don't know. Yeah, maybe... Yeah, if you can really write it, so this is, we're more, you know, from a practical point of view for using this equation to compute amplitude, but if you really want to, make it precise, you should first write the right-hand side as some deformation. I mean, it's, in principle, it's doable, but as I said, the second term is a bit tricky. So what you really want to study, from this perspective, what you really want to study is Q-bar acting on the amplitude, not on the remainder. Yes, and then you can study the right-hand side really as a deformation on the generator, and you can study the algebra more generally. But at this point, we haven't done that. Yeah.
Okay, so we should thank the speaker again.